Proverbs 27, verse 6 is where I got the title for this, and it looks like this. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. You've probably heard that phrase before, and I think the first part of it is easy. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. I mean, you can think about that, and you can go, okay, if I have a friend who really loves me and tells me something hard, it might hurt, but it's a faithful friend, I'm going to heal, it's going to be good for me. But the second part is a little bit harder. Deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. At first glance, you might think, now that's obvious. Here are my enemies. They flatter me. They don't tell me the truth. It's obvious who the enemies are. However, on closer inspection, when I look at the first phrase, faithful are the wounds of a friend, I'm motivated to accept rebuke and encouragement from my friends, but it doesn't really motivate me to go do it to anybody else. You know what I mean? When you think about the first phrase, it's personal. But when you look at the second phrase, deceitful are the kisses of an enemy, and I think about my friendships with my close friends, and I see sin in their life, and I pretend it's not there, and I say, you're doing great. I've really become their enemy by kissing their sin. That phrase motivates me to open my mouth and help them and encourage them toward the standard that Christ set. So that's where all this comes from. A few years ago, I had a really bad experience with rebuke, and so it made me get into the Word and see, okay, what does this word really mean? Because I'm so scared of it, and I don't want to do it to people, and I don't want it done to me. And what I found were really exciting words. Let me give you some definitions for the first four, and if you've got anything close to these, give yourself all kinds of points, all right? To rebuke actually means to set the standard. Only three times in the New Testament does the word rebuke occur when it means to strike, which is what we usually think of. It's something painful, something we don't want done to us. Someone comes up and says, "You are so ugly, smack." Only three times is it really that harsh. The other 19 times, it's the Greek word epitimeo, E-P-I-T-I-M-A-O. And that's the word that we get our word epitome from. The goddess of love and beauty is the epitome of Venus. You've heard of Venus? The epitome of rock and roll would be Elvis. The epitome of a talk show host would be Oprah. These are the people who set the standard for these areas, right? The epitome for holiness and righteousness would be Christ. So when we rebuke, all we're doing is setting the standard. We're saying, here's who Christ is. Here's where you are. Can I encourage you to become more like him? Well, when I start to understand rebuke like that, that doesn't seem like such a slap in the face. That seems like what the apostles did with each other, what Christ did with them. Exhort means to encourage and reconcile. Reconcile to what? Reconcile to the standard who is Christ. About half the times in the New Testament that we see the word rebuke, it's followed by exhort. So those two go together like peas and carrots. Rebuke and exhort, to encourage and reconcile to the standard who is Christ. How about to discipline? This is straight from your Psych 1113 class. Positive and negative reinforcement. I'll read this one a couple times. Positive and negative reinforcement that promotes a desired outcome. So you want to hide the word in your heart? You're going to have to discipline yourself to memorize the word and meditate on the word. And you might need to write it on your mirror or write it on your verse cards or tattoo it on your arm. You've got to find disciplines to get that into your life. If you want to learn to be a concert pianist, you don't take vitamin C and show up at the concert and expect to be able to play well. That would be incorrect. You have to practice scales, which are sometimes negative. And you never play the scales at the recital, do you? No, but they're the reinforcement, they're the discipline that gets the positive desired outcome. I can play classical piano. Punishment. Ready? Punishment is painful, negative consequence, a painful negative consequence that results from wrong thoughts and actions. punishment as a painful negative consequence that results from wrong thought and actions. Wrong thoughts and actions. If you've been reading the daily Bible reading plan this week in Exodus 32, the children of Israel made a golden calf and started worshiping that instead of God. They got a painful negative consequence. They all had to die. That would be punishment, okay? That's not rebuke. That's quite different. And actually, their punishment wasn't because they actually made the golden calf. Their punishment was because they refused to be reconciled to God when He gave them the opportunity after they sinned. So God's heart is about reconciliation. Think about what you know about addictive programs like Alcoholics Anonymous. It's full of rebuke. That's all it's about. We set the standard. We say we want to be clean and sober, or we want to be free from this addiction. And then we encourage until they reach the standard. And encourage is positive. You say, okay, I've been clean and sober for 3 days. And today was terrible, and I'm not clean and sober. What do we know about AA? Do they sit around in a circle and throw each other punches? You stupid drunk? No. They say, great, cheerleaders. We did it for 3 days. Now we start over and we try to go for 4. You encourage and encourage until they reach the standard. And for some people, my father-in-law, his standard now is like 27 years clean and sober. And he really thinks about it like that. Considers himself an alcoholic, although I've never seen the man take a drink. I've never known him as an alcoholic. But because he's been encouraged and encouraged until he's reached the standard, he's got that taken care of in his life. So let's clean out your old definitions of rebuke, what you thought it meant. This is it. This is it. The epitome is Christ, and He's the righteous goal that we're trying to go after. So give yourself 8 points if you got all those right. If you didn't, give yourself somewhere between 0 and 8. Multiple choice number 5. Recall the last time someone rebuked you. Was it last week? If you said A, give yourself 4 points. B gets 3 points. C gets 2 points. D gets 1 point. If you just can't remember, I even give you 1 point. Easy grader. Number 6. When someone tries to correct me, my first reaction is, that's only your opinion. Give yourself 1 point. Who do you think you are? Give yourself 1. I'm grateful. Give yourself 4. D gets 1, E gets 0. If you point out their sins too, that's really not quite worth a point. True or false? A true friend supports you and your decisions no matter what. False. You said false and you would be right. Oprah supports you and your decisions no matter what. But a true Christian friend sometimes has to say, I'm sorry, I disagree because of the word. And Proverbs 27:5 would be a good verse for that. It says, better is open rebuke than hidden love. Really goes well with Proverbs 27:6, which is how we found our title. Number 8. Usually when Christians try to correct something in my life, they're just attacking me because they're jealous of my walk with God. True or false? Oh, very good. Okay. If you happen to say true on that, it could be because you don't know Hebrews 3:13, which says, but encourage one another daily, as long as it's called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. If this is a way of a thought pattern in your life, it's probably that you haven't been encouraged in so long that you are now hardened by the deceitfulness of pride. So most of you said false. Number 9. If God really loved me, He wouldn't discipline me. False. Anybody know a verse to back that one up? Hebrews, say it. Anybody? Hebrews 12:4-6. Can you quote it for us? Okay, could anybody else? Write it down as a great reference. Somebody knows it.
I forget the number, but it's the Lord disciplines those He loves and He punishes everyone He accepts as a son. Mm-hmm.
Is that it? There you go. Someone could quote it. Another reference would be Psalm 50, pretty much the whole thing. But if you look at verses 15 through 23, you just see God's heart for reconciliation. He really does discipline us. And sometimes those are negative consequences. Sometimes those are positive consequences to get us where He wants us to be. He wants us to be reconciled to Him. He doesn't want punishment to have to happen. Another reference would be all of Proverbs 1, 2, and 3. Proverbs 1 says, don't reject wisdom. Proverbs 2, the benefits of wisdom. Proverbs 3, he disciplines those he loves. And those all just go together. You could spend a whole week doing a great inductive study on Proverbs 1, 2, and 3 and learn a ton about wisdom and rebuke. Number 10, true or false? Rebuking a friend can scar them for life. We seem to be divided. Tell me, truth speakers, what do you think? Why?
Because if you do it in the wrong way, they can really...
If you do it in a wrong way... Okay, if we really are clear on what the word rebuke means,
right,
then we would say false. Do you have any other reasons for saying false? Any scriptural reasons? Okay, you could take a look at 2 Corinthians 7, 8 through 10. I'll read it to you so you don't have to turn there right now. Even if I caused you sorrow by my letter, I do not regret it. Though I did regret it, I see that my letter hurt you, but only for a little while. Yet now I'm happy, not because you were made sorry, but because your sorrow led to repentance. For you became sorrowful as God intended, and so were not harmed in any way. Godly sorrow brings repentance that leads to salvation and leaves no regret. But worldly sorrow brings death. So, yes, if you rebuke a friend in love, with kind words, it might hurt initially. They might go, ouch, I can't believe you said that to me. But if they're seeking God and they want to follow him, this kind of sorrow will bring salvation and reconciliation in their life. One of the best instances, I see this every spring. Your best friend decides to propose to his girlfriend, and he asks you to be the best man, and you're thinking, oh my goodness, this couple is doomed for heartache. This is terrible. They've known each other 2 weeks. I can't do this. You would be multiplying kisses of an enemy by saying, sure, when's the date? I'll be there. If you have real reservations about them getting married. It would be very hard, and it is very hard, to go to a friend and say, I really have reservations about standing up with you because I don't think you should be getting married to this person or at this time. It's hard to do. But I tell you what, that kind of sorrow is a lot easier to take than watching their marriage fall apart 10 years later, having them come back to you and seeing their 3 children hurting because you didn't open your mouth when you knew there were going to be problems. That kind of sorrow is a lot harder to deal with. And that's a responsibility then that you'll deal with for the rest of your life. And when the marriage falls apart and you and the other groomsmen say, yeah, we saw that from the beginning, he's going to say, you what? You saw that from the beginning and none of you had the guts to say anything to me? And you all shrug and say, well, you wouldn't have listened anyway. You were just going to do what you're going to do. Oh, you can't bet on that. And even when it's hard, you have to open your mouth. Anybody know Hebrews 10:24? Pretty common verse. NIV version is the one I want. Thank you. Spur one another on. Any horse people in here? What's a spur? You kick the horse with it. Okay? That is not pleasant. But does when done correctly, does spurring a horse make the horse bleed, tear its hide, hurt the horse in a real severe way? No, it makes the horse go, ouch, I'm getting out of here. And that's what this kind of encouragement is supposed to do in our lives. It gets your attention. You might say, ouch, momentarily, but you get moving. It's not the kind of scar that you're going to, you know, walk around with it across your face for the rest of your life, and people are going to go, so, yikes, who spurred you? It's not the kind of scar you carry like that. It's the kind of character builder. Section B, giving rebuke, multiple choice. 11. When do I try to love my Christian friends with the love of the Lord? If you say always, give yourself 4 glorious points. When it's convenient, gets 3. When I think of it, gets 2. And when someone reminds me, you can have 1 point. Number 12. I feel angry when I see Christian friends who, any of those, give yourself 5 points if any of those things make you angry. Number 13. I remind my friends about the standard Christ set in these areas. Numbers 12. If you said frequently, say 5 points for you. Occasionally gets 4, rarely gets 3, never gets 2. And I wouldn't know where to start, that gets 1. When I know someone is being disobedient, this is number 14, I don't correct them because I'm scared I'll lose their friendship. Give yourself 2 points for your honesty. I want them to like me. Give yourself another 2 points. I don't really care about their walk with God. Gets no points. And it's none of my business. Gets one. They're never going to change anyway. Gets 0 points. How you doing? Yes, ma'am.
It also, it seems like some people just aren't in my sphere of, where they've given me permission to step into their life.
Okay, so a better way to answer, to word that question would have been, when I know a close friend is being disobedient. Would that have been better?
Right, but, where's the boundaries? Let's say someone that I'm not necessarily really close to, but it's very obvious that they're making sorry choices, and none of their close friends are saying anything.
None of their close friends are saying anything. Well, after this workshop, you should have the confidence to go to their close friends and say, rebuke's really not such a bad thing with your close friends. Maybe if you see something in this girl or guy's life, you could encourage them to get to the standard where God is. But I definitely wouldn't just go about rebuking anybody that I see sinning. I don't think we really have a biblical precedent for that. But if it's a close friend and you have a relationship, then I think you can. But you can encourage those friends of friends to be talking to their friends. I had a girl, a freshman girl, last fall, who was trying to get to know another Christian girl on her floor, but this Christian girl made a boyfriend right off the bat. Every time she went in the room, she and the boy are wrapped up together on the bed, and she's like, "It makes me so uncomfortable." So she comes to talk to me about it. I'm like, "Don't talk to me about it. If you think she's a Christian, tell her. I'd really like to get to know you, but every time I come in your room, you're getting to know somebody else pretty well. Is there any way we can work this out?" Because that makes me uncomfortable, and that doesn't match up with my idea of what a Christian girl should be doing with her boyfriend. And I don't know that conversation ever happened, but I got to encourage her that instead of gossiping, and she wasn't gossiping to me, but instead of telling other girls on the floor, this is what the girl's doing, go to her. Let her know. This really is hurting your reputation. This really doesn't make you look like the Christian that you say you are. But I didn't know the girl, so I couldn't go say that to her. Good question. Let me give you a story that might illustrate a few of these points. The story takes place in a small city. It was a secular city, a sensual city, a busy city with parking problems, not different from many you've visited. Many students came here from all over the world, some on scholarships, to hear the famous professors, go to sporting events and concerts, and to get autographs signed by its famous athletes. All the people coming and going created great commerce for the city. They built bigger buildings, planted more flower beds, and everyone lived comfortably. The once small town had evolved into a proud populace. They bought everything they craved. They entertained themselves extravagantly. They drank and partied from Thursday till Sunday. Their motto, just do it. Their bumper stickers, question authority. But something exciting was happening here. There was a small group of students who were followers of the Christ. They had rallies and non-alcoholic get-togethers, and generally tried to meet the Cretans where they lived, to build friendships, to love people the way Jesus did. Their older leader was always away speaking at conferences, but he had hired some young assistants to help with the work while he was out. News soon reached the elderly leader that some of the ministry team students had gone back to their old habits of living for themselves, sleeping with their girlfriends, drinking alcohol, and telling crude jokes. This news greatly saddened their minister, and he urged one of his assistants to go back to them and remind them of the commitments they had made. The assistant left reluctantly, but soon returned, not wanting to hurt the disobedient students. He was afraid they would think he was too hard on them. So the minister sent another assistant, this time with a letter. "You don't have to say a thing. Just tell them what this paper says. Please turn back to the narrow path you began on, for now you are confusing the younger Christians, and they think that Christ was as immoral as you are." This time, the message was delivered. But the students had lost respect for the minister and for God's laws. They accused him of turning against them and of being jealous of their wealth and good luck. The minister sent 4 hard letters of rebuke and made a personal visit before the arrogant students were restored to the ministry. But even then, some were asked to leave because their hearts were hardened. Does this sound familiar? You've read this story somewhere before. We have copies of 2 of those letters The second letter we call 1 Corinthians, and the fourth letter is called 2 Corinthians. Paul was the minister, and this is what all of Corinthians is about. It's about rebuke. So if you really want to dig in and see, what does it look like? How does it happen? What's the process? How long do I go in rebuking a friend? 1 and 2 Corinthians are a great blueprint for that. How about an Old Testament story? I already told you, Exodus 32, just from this week's reading. The Israelites make this golden calf. Moses comes down from the mountain. He's got the Ten Commandments. He looks around. And the first thing he says is not to rebuke the Israelites, but he says to their leader, Aaron, how did they drag you into this? And you know what Aaron does? He's just like mumble mouth. They just told me what to do, and I didn't. I mean, can you just see Moses? He's like, if they said jump off a bridge, Aaron, what would you do? And Aaron just, I mean, he's just completely like, I'm not in control of myself. I can't be held responsible. Then in verse, this is Exodus 32:26, Moses gives everybody an opportunity to reconcile. He reminds them, I mean, he's holding the Ten Commandments in his hand. Number one, don't have any gods before me. What is this? Golden calf. They're just not getting it at all. God's brought them through all this stuff, and they just keep going, my way, my way, my way. But he doesn't say, okay, everybody die. He says, who is on God's side? And all the Levites go, oh, that's us. We're supposed to be on God's side. It doesn't say that the Levites didn't participate in the Golden Calf Festival. It just says the Levites were the only ones who said, oh, yeah, I'm supposed to be on God's side. So they come over here with Moses. Everybody else is like just mind-numb robots following the Golden Calf. And then he has to say to Aaron and the Levites, you must punish these who are not on God's side. That's a hard rebuke to give. Hey, compared to going out and killing my sons and neighbors and friends, I think I can give a verbal rebuke. That was hard punishment. These guys who participated had to go kill all those people because they refused to be reconciled to God. God's heart is reconciliation. Let's look at the last true and false section. We're doing good. True, false, number 15. We can use the Bible to set standards for conduct in the lives of non-Christians. True or false?
False.
Any truths out there? How about the Ten Commandments? Do we use that to make all kinds of laws in this land and others? We really do. We really do. And there are thousands of other ones. Pretty much just read Deuteronomy. And we have a law for all those things. Now, the courts may not claim this came from the Bible, but these are where the laws came from. They came from God. So that one would be true. Number 16. Oh, yes, ma'am?
Is there a scripture reference for that?
For the Ten Commandments? Anybody?
Yeah, because I know where the Ten Commandments are, but where Jesus says that we use our Christian standards and hold the non-Christians to it.
Anything in 1 Corinthians 5, I'd go there. I've got 2 Timothy written here, but that is definitely just to Christians. That's where we get it. Yes, Amanda?
It just seems to me like God's standards are only for the Christians. So it just seems like the non-Christians, I mean, that's not for them. You know, like they don't...
Why do we punish murderers? Do we say, are you a Christian? Well, then I'll punish you. And if not, just go free. You know what I'm saying?
Right, but we can't put on non-Christian. We shouldn't be. We shouldn't cuss. We shouldn't, we cannot project on them those standards because they aren't their standards.
Not all standards.
Not all standards. That's a good way to say it. Not all the standards in the Bible are going to be understood by all civilizations, but all civilizations have their equivalent of the Ten Commandments. You're not supposed to steal from other people. There's no civilization that says that's okay. There's no civilization that says you can't be an adulterer if you're a Christian, But for everybody else, it's a free-for-all. There's no civilization that says that. There's no husband, non-Christian, who says to the whole street, hey, my wife is yours.
Right, but we can't, like, it's not our place to rebuke our non-Christian friends, is what I'm kind of asking.
Okay, but the question is, we can use the Bible to set standards for conduct in the lives of non-Christians. And I would say yes, on an individual, one-to-one, personal basis, I'm not going to walk up to my non-Christian friend Joe and say, hey, buddy, you're using the Lord's name in vain and he hates it. You're going to hell. I'm probably not going to use that approach, but as a civilization, culture to culture, we certainly can. Personally, that gets a lot more messy. But definitely, if you're in law school, everything comes back to these statutes that came from God. Does that clear that up? So personally, sure, it gets really hard to enforce that. I mean, I'm not going to pull you over and say, hey, you're supposed to be doing 55, lady. What are you going to say about yourself? Sure, I can't enforce those laws because I'm not the law. But our culture has people in place who do enforce the laws. Romans 13 would be a good place to look for this authority structure. Romans 13, that God sets up governments and police and authorities, and the things that they're enforcing are his laws. Good question. Another?
Just war theory is something that
would fit under that. Just war theory would totally fit under that. Those principles come from the Word. Are we at true, false, number 16? The Bible allows us to judge Christians, true or false. True? Anybody have any references for that? Okay, there's a false. You want to give us a reference for your false or a reason? Based on the Matthew 7 verse?
Sure.
Probably the most misquoted, thrown around. Everybody who's even not a Christian knows Matthew 7, 1 says, don't judge. But Galatians 6, can you quote that one to me?
Or
but it doesn't say don't do it. Can you give them a reference so they can write that one down?
No, I'm saying that's support of.
Oh, support of judging.
Well,
go ahead.
Definition of judging?
That's where we need to go. A definition of judging.
What do you mean by,
what do you mean by judging? That's where it all falls apart. Okay, there are two definitions. There's one that says judging that conveys with it conviction. I'm the judge. You have been sentenced. You're guilty. You've been sentenced. And here's your sentence that you're going to live out. That's one kind of judging. The kind of judge, the Greek word that we see in Matthew 7, is actually kritikos, C-R-I-T-I-C-O-S, which means critical, discerning. If you take the wrong definition of judging, and I say Joe's shirt's red, you can say to me, hey, don't judge Joe's shirt. Who are you to say his shirt is red? That would be the wrong definition. So Matthew 7 is saying, don't be hypercritical of people until you've looked at your own life. It's not saying, well, what's the verse say? Do not judge unless you also be judged with the same judgment. And the word is kritikos there. Don't be hypercritical unless you're ready to have that hypercriticism right back at you. So look at your own life. If you have this sin problem, don't try to tell somebody they don't have it, or they have it. Hypocritical is the same word. Hypocritical, kritikos, yes, sir.
You say it's to judge their action as a person as a whole?
Possibly. Although if you're looking at Matthew 7, 1, you also have to look at 7:15 and 16. In the same passage, Jesus says, by their fruit you will know them, you will recognize them. So he says right there, do look at their fruit of their life, and you can know if they're a Christian or if they're not. Or if they are of a bad tree or of a good tree. A bad tree can't bear good fruit, a good tree can't bear bad fruit. And it's by the fruit of their life that you'll know them. So this is the one verse I would say our Christian culture just takes completely out of context and uses to beat up Christians and to say, yuck, 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 you can't judge me. Look at 1 Corinthians 5:12 through 13, if you want to get really clear on how we should treat each other. It says, what business is it of mine to judge those outside the church? Is that not God's job? God will judge those. Are you not to judge those inside the church? Expel the wicked man from among you. If you're unclear on Matthew 7, read 1 Corinthians 5:12 and 13 because it's very clear. Expel the wicked man from among you. You've got to be critically judging the fruit of their life to come to expulsion. This is the verse that the Catholic doctrine of excommunication actually comes from. 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17. A lot of you also know that. The Word of God is useful for teaching, rebuking, and correcting so that the man of God may be thoroughly equipped for every good work. So again, the reason we do this is all about reconciliation and equipping. It's positive outcomes. Question?
Are there any verses that kind of temper that or give provisions on it? Because it just seems like taking the permission to judge Christians could be taken out of hand and go a little too far.
Okay, could you give me an example where that might go too far?
People who judge out of pride, for example.
Yes, that's what Matthew 7 is about.
Okay.
And if you read Matthew 7, 1 through 5, it's saying, examine your own life. Don't rush into a rebuke on somebody. Don't be eager to do it. Definitely. That's what that chapter, or that little passage is about.
Are there any others?
Probably. And that would be a great study for you to do. You could spend a week doing some cross references and finding those. Do you have another one?
Corinthians 5, but in that same part where he's talking about the excommunication,
mm-hmm.
isn't there a lot of other things about, it's almost like the last straw.
Yes.
You're rebuking first.
And we are going to look at that in a small group activity. That would be Matthew 18 that gives very specific steps. There's a whole process before expelling comes. So that's a very good question. And I would say, if you feel like there's something in your friend's life that you need to go to them about, you do never go eagerly. You should always be dreading this because you know it's going to cause some hurt. And you need to be prayerfully asking the Holy Spirit, is this what you're doing in their life right now? Since I've been on staff for a while, I see freshmen all the time who come in and this girl might have just all kinds of junk hanging out in her life. I could make a list, a whole page long of sin areas that she might reconcile the standard of God. But I don't go to her with a list and say, okay, here's what I made for you today. Would you like to see? No, man. I pray and ask God. He's had her on a journey her whole life before I ever met her. He's got something specific that he's working on in her life right now. And I want to figure out, if I can, through the Holy Spirit, what is God working on in her life? How can I come alongside her and encourage her where God's already working? A lot of times when God's convicting me to encourage a girl on a certain topic, when we get together, before I can get it out of my mouth, she says, God's really told me this in my quiet time this morning, and I really am stinky when it comes to this. And I'm always like, whew, I'm so glad I didn't have to say that. You said that first. But I was prepared at the time to talk to her about an issue in her life. So definitely go in love and gentleness and respect. And if you don't have any scripture, keep your mouth closed. If it's not a standard Christ set and it's just your opinion, you might feel free to say, this is my opinion. I don't think this is a good time for that or the other. Or maybe you shouldn't take 21 hours next semester if you want to lead a Bible study. Those are opinions. And I can give those and let a girl know those are my opinions. Does that make sense? But if you're really trying to rebuke to the standard of Christ, you need to have the standard of Christ, his words, to give that girl or guy. Question?
You say guys should stick with using guys?
Definitely, yeah. And if you look at Romans 13 again with authority structures, I don't think we really ever see any biblical example of a woman rebuking a man. Now, she might be part of the Matthew 18 process as a witness. She might be part of encouraging her husband in some way. But even then, there's a lot of debate on whether that should happen from wife to husband. So definitely, guys with guys, girls with girls. And like I told Amanda, the other thing, if you see a guy, if you see someone of the opposite sex with a huge sin problem, and you've got a maybe a relationship with one of her close girlfriends, you might could say, you know, have you guys talked about this? And you could encourage a girl to get some time with her, and that's okay. But you don't want to gossip when you do it. You don't want to slander this person's character. You want to be prayerful. You want to be real careful. We're down to 17, I think. True or false? The New Testament teaches us to rebuke each other daily. True. And ouch for us. Hebrews 3:13. But encourage one another daily, as long as it's called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. That encourage in the Greek is actually epitomeo. Set the standard every day. And some of that's going to be done with your own life. If you're trying to live a standard that's a reflection of Christ, you're going to be doing that. But sometimes we need to do it with words as well. Number 18, true or false, a disciple has no personal rights. What would be the personal rights of a disciple? Anybody know Galatians 2:20? Thanks, Debbie. I no longer live. If I'm dead, I don't have any rights. Dead bodies have no rights. Another verse for that would be 2 Corinthians 5:14-15. For Christ's love compels us, for we are convinced that one died and he died for all, that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for them and was raised again. I have no personal rights. So when I say to myself, I don't have to rebuke you. I want you as a friend, and I don't want to risk that. I have a right to my friends. That's a lie. You don't have a right. If God has told you to encourage a brother or sister, you must do it or be disobedient. And number 19, when we refuse to correct our friends, we are in direct disobedience to God. Oh, I just gave it away. True. And that's where you can go to 1 Corinthians 5:19-13, and we've already really looked at that. What business is it of mine to judge those outside the church? Are you not to judge those inside the church? And I know this is hard, but if you'll clear your memory bank of what you used to think rebuke meant and think about it in the positive way, it's not punish your friends. It's set the standard. Remind them, here's who Christ is. Here's who we want to be. And at the same time, you can say, here's where I am. You don't have to be perfect in all these things before you can encourage your friends. This is super, super positive.
What's the reference again?
Reference again was 1 Corinthians 5:9-13. Oh, I wanted to give you another one on number 17. Luke 17:3, we've heard preached hundreds of messages on forgiveness. It's the verse that says, does somebody know that? Watch yourselves. If your brother sins, rebuke him. If he repents, forgive him. If he sins against you 7 times in the day, forgive him 7 times 7, right? You've all heard that verse hundreds of times about in the context of forgiveness. But the very first thing in that verse says, rebuke him. And if he repents, forgive him. So let's focus on that. We need to practice doing this. But we won't do it as long as we think it's punishment, right? So it's not punishment. I'm going to give you the small group activity time now. When are we supposed to be out of here? Anybody know?
Pretty.
Oh, stop it. Okay, we're going to be quicker on this. If you're looking at your last page, it says that you have, what, 7 minutes to prepare? I'm not going to give you that long. Take about 4. And you're going to get in a group with other people who have your same color. So let's put the green papers in this corner, the blues back there. Lavender in that corner, yellow in this corner, hot pink in the middle of the room. So you've got 4 minutes to prep this and then present it to the rest of us. Nobody else has your passage, so you got to do a good job here.
The other side of that is, if you don't heed their instruction, we discussed that very negative things happen, even to the point of like physical poverty and physical repercussions in your life, and also spiritual repercussions. And that's not very exciting, but that's the gist of it.
Any questions for the blue group?
What kind of verses
what
did you
verses?
Have?
Huh?
What verses did you have?
Our verses were Proverbs 10:17, Proverbs 13:18, Proverbs 17:10, Proverbs 25:12, Proverbs 27:5, and Psalm 141:5.
If you didn't get all that down, I'm going to have a sign up here with emails, and I'll send you some of this stuff in an easier format than this funny test. Let's go to the lavender group, please. Where are you guys? Lavenders? That's you. Okay, everybody look back there. Tell us what you know. I guess I'll give the blue group 10 whole points. That was pretty good. They were the first to go. Everybody else is going to have to reach the standard. Right. God is hoping that because we cut them off from all fellowship, they will miss that so much that they'll be willing to get rid of the sin in their life in order to have be restored to fellowship with Him and with us. So that's the reason for the harshness. And if you don't understand that, you'll never do it. Let's look. Thank you very much. 10 points for that fabulous group. Number yellow. What do you have for us? A rap? A song and dance? A pantomime?
Okay. Our reference is Matthew 7, 1 through 5. And it talks about the first one is the first verse being, do not judge that you will not be judged. Then moves on to have the picture of, don't try to remove the speck from your brother's eye because you've got a log in your eye, basically. Mm-hmm. And there's probably a couple reasons for that. One, because the issue is you don't want to be judged. You don't want to be hypersensitive. So you should correct in a way that you would want to be corrected back. You know, you don't want someone to come to you and slam down. The same standard. There's also standards you need to be living towards, the standards of Christ. You kind of are like a mediocre bar, you know, the imitators of me, just as I'm imitators of Christ, that someone can eventually, you know, get up to. So you've got to have a standard that's high enough that someone can be shooting for that standard.
Ephesians 5:1.
As you're shooting for a higher standard of faith. Because the issue is, I mean, if you correct somebody and they see in your own life this major issue, this major sin, you know, they can look at you and say, how can you even come to me about that? Because, I mean, you do it too, or you do something else that's bad, and we don't want to supposed to do that. I just said that earlier, so. There can be major issues and major breaks that can occur there because of kind of the hypocrisy that's involved. We also talked about the issue of using character when you correct. You should be correcting towards the standard of Christ rather than your own opinion. And you should correct based on patterns, not individual ways. Just something they do once, and they don't ever do again. They've never done before. I mean, it was just a break.
Anything to add, rest of the group? Nicely done. Any questions for the yellow group? Okay, let's move on to hot pink. I'm standing right in front of you. Oh, hot pink up here. if you guys would scoot to the side, they have drawn a flow chart for us of Matthew 18. Creative. Lovely. Take it away, Brittany.
Oh, okay. Someone else want to come talk about it since I wrote it?
Yeah, someone else from the group?
Oh, this is the process of church discipline. Like, if your brother sins, you're supposed to go to him one-on-one and confront him with it. And if he listens, he's one, restored.
Yay.
He's changed. and if he doesn't listen, the next step is to go to him with two or three others and confront him with the same rebuke. If he listens, once again, he's sharing. He's going back over. If he doesn't listen, you're supposed to confront him as a church body. And then once again, if he listens, he can still be reconciled. If he doesn't listen, you're supposed to treat him as a pagan.
Yeah. Treat him as a pagan. Don't eat with him.
Yeah.
Send him out of the church. Excellent job, guys. 10 points. What happens if he's not reconciled and you can't find three witnesses to go with you? Then you need to go, ooh, maybe I was wrong. If nobody else sees this in his life, I'm the only one that does, maybe you're wrong.
We have Ezra 7:10. And what this points out is there's three steps in rebuking and being able to. And the first step is really they study the word. Because if you don't know it, first of all, you're not going to be able to teach to begin with if you don't know it. Then the next step is observance. If you're not doing what you're studying, then you really have no right to be rebuking in the first place or teaching. One of some references we were thinking of for study is 2 Timothy 3:16 through 17,
mm-hmm.
and Joshua 1:8, and for observance, Matthew 7:1 and James 1:22. And then for teaching, then once you have those, then you can pass it on to someone else so that they can learn to obey it too. And one verse is 2 Timothy 2:2 for teaching, and also just the things we've been going over about the setting the standard of rebuke. And now we have a little illustration. Can I use this jacket?
It's okay with me.
Okay, thank you. This is just hypothetical. This is not true. Okay.
The 11th.
The 11th commandment: Thou shalt not wear red. Guess I shouldn't wear red then.
He studied. He's practicing.
My good friend, Teresa, I'm seeing something in your life.
Please tell me.
I found that you shouldn't wear red.
You shouldn't wear red? Where does it say
that? The 11th commandment.
Oh, what a beautiful picture. Give yourselves 10 points and grab a pen. I want to give you just a couple little things to wrap up. You are a fun group. Everyone has passed the test. Hopefully, I have been like Ezra 7:10 today. As you guys were working on that, someone asked a really good question. How can I rebuke someone if I have the same problem in my life? Well, hopefully I can be an example to you. I am not good at receiving rebuke. I'm not good at giving it. But hopefully I've just rebuked you all today by setting the standard and showing you what the Word says about it and telling you, I want to get better at this too. And I'll encourage you to continue to practice to get better. A few problems with giving and receiving rebuke. We're going to end with this. If you have problems receiving rebuke, you may have a pride or arrogance problem. This is my personal problem. God's been showing me over the last few months that I have, well, If you're on the OUBSU staff, you get excited constantly, and you hear Max's vision, and you hear about training people, and you're just so intent on that, and it's so wonderful. And then you go out other places, and you see that nobody's talking about that. And it's a huge temptation in my life to become prideful and arrogant and say, I'm the only one that knows this stuff, and you guys don't know anything. And that's sin, and that's stinky to God, and He hates it. But He's showing me that the reason I still have it in my life and I'm not getting better at it is because I have allowed so few people to rebuke me on it. And so since He revealed that to me, I've been struggling to find Christian women and men that I trust and say, will you help me with this? And since then, I've added about 12 new people. And I've said, I want you to just keep your nose out for arrogance in my life. And when you smell it, come and talk to me. Because that's something that grieves God, and I don't want it in my life. Another problem might be bitterness. If you have a wall, a barrier between you and the person who's giving the rebuke, you're going to have a real hard time receiving that. Another problem would be lack of respect. If you see the person who's giving you the rebuke as less mature than you, then you're going to have a real hard time receiving it. So those are three problems that you can work on in your own life. Problems with giving rebuke. If you're a people pleaser, you are going to have a tough time setting Christ's standard. If you are too empathetic, meaning if they can talk you out of it once you've started it, you go, oh, yeah, I can see why you did that. You're right, God's wrong. Then you're going to have a real hard time setting the standard. If you're scared of losing relationships, and you won't take the risk to set the standard, you're going to have a hard time. And then if you just flat out don't care about obeying God, you're going to have a hard time. And the story I'll end with, because I know you've got to have a break, is what started me on this whole word study to begin with. About 7 years ago, 6 years ago, we were in seminary, and I was discipling a younger woman who was a newly married wife. And she, we'd been getting along great. We knew each other really well. We're praying together every week. She was really growing. And I just sensed God saying to me, she has a prejudice in her life against people who didn't grow up in her socioeconomic state. She was really friendly, outgoing with people who had the kind of money she came from. With people who came to seminary and didn't drive a nice car, she made fun of them when they weren't around. And that God just was really saying to me, you've got to look at 1 Corinthians 13 and show her what real love is. And just help her get closer to where I am on loving all people. Because if her husband's going to be in the ministry for a long time, this is going to stink up the church wherever she goes. And I said, God, she's too young. She's not ready for this. She's not going to like it. She's not going to listen to me. And I argue with God for about 3 months. And finally, my husband, who's my best rebuke and encourager, said, Jen, how long are you going to fight God about this? If you're really going to be a disciple maker, you're going to have to say hard things to people. And if you're not willing to do that, then you're not one. And I went, oh, I want to obey God, but I know she's not going to respond well. And I just don't want any ugliness between us because I like her. And she really likes me. And so about a week later, I hadn't slept for a week because every time I laid down, God was like, hello, I'm talking to you. Every time I opened my Bible, He was like, are you ready yet? I'm still waiting. You need to be obedient. And finally, I was like, okay. So I got my verses together, took her out for a Coke, and I'm like, Lee, I love you, but you are really stinking it up in this one area. And here's what God says about it. And I love you, and I'm going to help you, and let's work on it. And she said, thanks, Jen. This has been good for me. We went home. She went in the house, called her mom and said, you'll never believe what this girl said to me. Called all her friends and said, and they were like, oh, of course you're not like that. Talked to her husband. He was like, I can't believe she said that. And it's been 7 years and she's never spoken to me again. And for about the first 3 months, I was like, okay, God, see, I told you this wasn't going to work. And He said, I want your obedience. I don't want you to be a people pleaser. I don't want you to care about relationships more than me. I want you to love me and my word and what I say at any cost. And I said, but this is stinky and it really hurts. And He said, but I'm here and it's okay. And if you want to be a disciple maker, you're going to have to risk relationships. And he said, this is what I want for her life. And even if that means you never have another conversation with her again, it's what I want for her life. And about once a year, I look at my husband and I say, can I call her and take it all back? And he says, you know, she probably doesn't even remember this. It's been 7 years, okay? You're the only one still talking about this. And he says to me, did God tell you something different today? And I say, oh, no. And he said, did you do it out of love? Or did you do this the wrong way? And I said, no, I really did love her when I did it. And he says, then you can't call her and take it back. And I go, okay, you're right. And it's hard. And it's a hard lesson that I've had to learn. But you know, since I did that, it's easier for me now. Because if Brittany has something that I see, I know, okay, the consequences could be she'll never talk to me again, or she'll get closer to God. And then I have to say, am I willing to take that risk? Yeah, I did it once before, and I can take it. If she never talks to me again, I can handle it, because I know I've been obedient. And that's where it ends. And that's what gives me the courage to know he wants obedience from me. And this is what the Word says we have to do. So let me encourage you. I'm not good at it yet, but I sure want to be, because I want to train men and women to be more like him. He's the standard. I'm not. I love you guys. Let me pray for you. God, thanks for this group. Thanks for your Word that teaches us how to be more like you. Father, I pray that as we go out and encourage one another and train people around us, that we'll have your Holy Spirit guiding us, and we won't do anything out of selfish ambition. We won't do anything to make ourselves look better or out of pride or arrogance, but that we'll walk in humility and we'll be able to receive rebuke from others and to give it in a godly way. In your precious name, amen.